And now, Forward with Falk. Join Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen as they navigate their way through the political thicket. Dave, this is the Labor Day weekend. The summer's over, officially, not geologically, but culture-wise.
Yes.
And, Labor Day was created in opposition to May Day. You remember that Samuel Gompers felt that the socialists controlled May Day, so he wanted to have a holiday for labor in opposition to what he regarded as a socialist encroachment on the American labor movement. And he sponsored Labor Day, and the Congress took it up and made it a holiday. And it used to be a holiday with parades and celebrations, as was May Day. And now there is no Labor Day celebration, as there is no May Day celebration.
Well, May Day's become law week in the United States. Europe's still a little different. But.
Yeah. But it just shows the weakness, the decline of the strength of the labor movement and of the efforts by workers to assert their independent interests in the American political system, that even this holiday, Labor Day, has fallen into decline as the unions have declined. Only 6% of private sector workers are organized into unions. Hard to see how you could have a vigorous Labor Day if there's no movement behind Labor Day.
I note that Joe Biden goes out of his way to talk about unions, and I believe this Labor Day is going to be in Philadelphia again talking to unions. But as you say, a lot of them are public sector now rather than private sector.
Right.
Although the private sector had a major victory a couple weeks ago with the UPS drivers. I was talking to the one that delivers to our office. And I said, what do you feel about the new contract? And he said, I feel great about it. Those are his words. He said, the last two contracts were terrible. They screwed us. This one, he said, was good.
And it's interesting because it was that UPS contract, those two last UPS contracts, which provoked such dismay among the UPS workers that the entire Teamsters Union was convulsed, and it led to a turnover in the leadership of the Teamsters Union nationwide, as a more militant, rank-and-file-oriented group took over the union from the Hoffa administration.
Yeah, when you boil down to it, though, this the union movement and a lot of things we see is really about power and who has the power to control things. Although I do want to note, that I saw a small article about the fact that a UPS driver, a veteran of some 28 years, died on the job during the Texas heat wave because the vehicles are not air conditioned. And that was one of the things that the union fought for this time, is when they buy new trucks, they're going to be air conditioned rather than rely on these fans that do little more than blow hot air back at you.
You're making a good point that about the union struggle is about power. It is about power because either workers have rights on the job, either workers can get a share of the profits that they create, or they can't. And if they don't get it, then the corporate owners get it. It's a question of power. Who's going to get what part of the wealth that's created by the labor's, the workers' labor. And it's not a win-win situation. If I don't get a higher wage, you get a bigger profit. It's just that simple. And the question is, how does it work? And that's a question of power. That's not a question of logic. It's not a question of morality. It's a question of power. And it's always been that. And when people talk about union bosses as if the bosses who own the company are equivalent to the bosses who run the union, they're distorting the entire relationship. The union is an institution which exists to check the power of the owner of the company and to check the amount of the wealth created by the workers he gets to keep. There's no such thing as a union boss because the union workers don't control the company and they don't have a legal claim to the profit of the company. Only power gives them any part of the power, profit of the company distributed in higher wages or benefits.
Yeah, well, certainly over the last 40 years or so, we've had an imbalance with regard to between capital and labor. And it's highly favored capital.
And it's produced the greatest social crisis in the country's history almost. And we have the greatest inequality in the country than we've ever had, I think. Well, not counting slavery, but since industrial capitalism came to dominate the economy after the Civil War.
Yeah, I mean, and you just look at the fact that they haven't been able to raise the minimum wage in this country for, was it 15 years now or something like that?
And the fact that workers' purchasing power has actually gone down. The wage, the nominal wage may be rising, but the purchasing power has steadily declined since the 1960s.
Yeah, while the people who, you know, from the top have been getting rewarded more and more.
Yeah.
And it's we're starting to see some signs of it changing, but it's very slow and it's very, very sporadic.
And it's not going to change unless the workers are organized to enforce the change, first to demand it and then to enforce it, ultimately by the right to strike, which, you know, the right to work laws make impossible in many states. But without that, the workers are handicapped. They're fighting for what they are fighting for, not with one hand tied behind their backs, but with their legs and their hands all tied, hogtied.
Yeah. Although, you know, it was interesting that since the pandemic, there has been a shift away from the power of management to control everything. They've had a hard time convincing workers to work for the previous conditions that they were working for, particularly in the service industries.
Exactly.
Other things we see now where, with the pandemic, people were working from home. And we've had management say, we want you back in the office. And the workers are saying, not so fast.
Right.
Not so fast. We found out that there's better things. Our lives are better when we can manage them differently.
But of course, only certain types of work can be done that way. Certain types of office work. You can't run a factory that manufactures things at home. You can't take care of the elderly and the sick if you stay in your home. You have to go to their home or their hospital. So there's a limit to how much that's switch can take place.
Yeah, and
but
of course
the point is that workers want better working conditions.
And
if the offices had better working conditions, people wouldn't mind being in the offices.
And better remuneration for what they're doing.
Absolutely.
As a recognition. You know, as I often say, it's whether you look at your workers as an asset or a liability. And, smart companies consider their workers to be assets. But there's so many companies, and particularly those with these authoritarian-type leaders who think that they're a liability.
Right. And the big companies like Starbucks, where you have Howard Schultz, who has a paternalistic attitude. The workers are his children. He's taking care of them. Or Amazon, where you work at unbelievably monstrous rates with split-second timing and horrible working conditions, heat that decimates people, makes them ill. It's just...
Yeah, it's not just there. It's in healthcare as well. You see doctors leaving the profession because they've gotten... their practices have been bought out by these management-type companies. And they're told that you can only spend X number of minutes with a patient. You can only order these kinds of tests and whatever, you know, they find that frustrating. It's what happens when, people know the cost or the price of everything, but the value of nothing.
But, you know, you're making an interesting point. Doctors were considered to be people in their own business. You're describing doctors as workers. That's the progress of capitalism. Consolidation, amalgamation. And we've had a very interesting example of that announced this week in Scranton. Yeah. With the newspaper industry, where the Scranton Times, which was owned by the Lynett family, and they ran it for the last 130 years, they sold it. To who? To a hedge fund.
Yes. And it's not the first newspaper to be sold to a hedge fund.
Most of the newspapers in the country are owned by hedge funds at this point,
yeah.
Right?
And that's the thing. They're not newspaper people. They don't understand what a newspaper is supposed to be for. They just think that it's a commodity that can be jiggered and diced up and monetized to every degree, the same way as they've applied it to other industries and manufacturing and what have you. Remember, that was the Mitt Romney model, what they would do, come in and load up debt and take out big management fees and run the company into the ground. And they didn't care that the company was made up of real people who serviced real people, who did real things that people wanted. It was just for the here and now. There was no long-term.
No, but that's the inevitable. I mean, that is the constant trend of capitalism. That's how it works. The big swallow the little, and money dominates over everything else. The financial interest dominates over the manufacturing interest. We don't live in the America of the 1890s. Right. We live in the America of the 2020s, where finance capital dominates manufacturing capital. The Trumpists and even the Bidens want to go back to an era where manufacturing capital dominates. Cannot happen. Cannot happen. Will not happen. Does not happen. You may have industrial policy, but the lead interest in the entire system is the interest of the investor, not the interest of the manufacturer.
Well, that's the Milton Friedman school.
Yeah, but that's what he's correctly, you know, reflecting what the actuality is of capitalism.
And you, of course, you need both. You need capital and you need labor. The question is getting it balanced in the proper way.
Then you get back to the clash of interest. The balance is who's stronger in terms of who's organized better or who's organized. The only one who's organized is capital. The labor can't win.
I mean, there was, in the newspaper industry, they went through in the last relatively short period of time, they went through a sea change of things. Investing, at one point it used to be investing in more modern printing presses, and now it's investing in computer type of software and that part of the industry. And it's changed.
It's a profound influence on politics.
Sure.
Because, you know, these hedge funds, they take on enormous debt. The Lynettes are going to make money on this sale. The company that bought them isn't dipping into its pocket to pay them out of what they've accumulated. They're going to borrow the money. And they're going to pay the Lynettes with money that they borrow. Now they got to pay back that money, and they expect that the Times Tribune is going to start producing cash that the Lynettes couldn't produce in order to pay the Lynettes what they are owed for selling the company. There's only one way to do that: get rid of workers, cut the payroll, so that it's more efficient.
Cut your costs.
Yeah, cut your costs.
Well, there's going to be a couple of things. Well, and they've done this in some of the other newspapers that they've run in Denver, the Post, and Chicago. And
well, the Gannets are the Gannett newspapers are the most famous. And the Gannett newspapers, they had hundreds of newspapers. And they close them when they become unprofitable. They owned 600 newspapers not too long ago. They're down to 400 now. But more importantly was they had 25,000 employees. They're down to 11,000 employees on all of these newspapers. So that's what's going to happen in the Times Tribune. They may tell the workers at the Times Tribune, you're not going to get fired, which may be true for the next week. But come look at it a year from now.
Well, the other thing that they're going to do is go more digital.
Yes.
You won't be seeing a published paper, a hard copy paper.
What you won't be seeing is local news, because there'll be no reporters to report the local news.
Because that's what basically a newspaper is supposed to be.
Yep.
And that's what's important for, like you said, the politics, but the lifeblood of the community, to know what's going on, to be able to monitor your government or other businesses in the community. And, didn't we just have that incident in Kansas where they the owner of a restaurant got the sheriff's department to raid a newspaper?
Yes, exactly.
Because there was an expose in the works.
Yes. And even raided the home of the owner, of the home of the publisher, who was a 98-year-old woman. She died the next day.
Yeah, killed her from the stress.
Yeah. But the thing is, we have in Pennsylvania, we have 67 counties. 42 of them are considered rural counties. I live in one of them. We don't have a daily newspaper. We have a weekly newspaper that's owned by the Times Tribune. It has a daily. It has a circulation of 1,200. The big news, town city to the north doesn't cover our county. The big city to the south doesn't cover our county. No television network covers the county. There's a local radio station, which is basically a Christian radio station. It doesn't have much news. There is no news. Now the Times Tribune is sold. The local weekly is going to disappear. There's no question about it. The person who was the reporter for 30 years retired. It's already no longer filled with local news. There's absolutely no way to know within this county what's going on within this county in the government or in business, the economy, schools, nothing. And if there's 41 other counties like this, which there are, that's most of the state. Now, how do you have democracy if you don't really know what the hell's going on? And there's no way to know. There's no body gathering the information anywhere, not on the internet, not in print, not on television. So how are you going to have democracy?
Between that and the attempts to suppress information, that are out there. Of course, we've had this in radio for a while. We have these big groups like Sinclair, mm-hmm. Who take over and direct what kind of news goes on the air or puts out propaganda pieces and tells the local stations that they have to run these pieces. It's certainly a world that's much changed since when you and I were growing up, more so even with you. I remember all the newspapers in New York City.
We had, when I was a kid, there was...
seven or eight?
Oh, more. Let's see. There was, in the morning, there was the Times, the News, the Mirror. There was one other I can't remember. That's in English.
The Herald. Yeah. You used to have...
The Herald Tribune. Right. So you had five
Herald
morning
Tribune,
newspapers.
You had the World Telegram and Sun.
That was in the afternoon. And the Journal
which was
American.
Which was a Journal American.
Yeah.
Which...
The Post. Right.
Alexander Hamilton would roll over in his grave if he saw the Post. But, of course, don't forget those papers back 200 years ago were founded in order to propagate their own propaganda, and the Civil War. You had papers across the country that were known as the Republican or the Democrat, literally in their names.
Yeah.
St. Louis Globe Democrat, Scranton had a Scranton Republican.
Right.
Came the Scranton Tribune. The Union, San Diego Union,
right?
All of those things, and the Hearst papers. But you had competition. you had competition.
You had competition, but you know the New Yorker had a wonderful columnist named A.J. Liebling. He was a world famous essayist, and he published a weekly column, a critique of the press, in the New Yorker for many, many, many years. And he once wrote, "Freedom of the press is meant for people who own a press."
Yeah.
Which, you know, we shouldn't romanticize the past.
Right.
But the truth was that it was easier to get opinions out in the past because there were a multiplicity of ways in which you could do it. You know, if the Daily News was a reactionary newspaper, as it was, but it had a million daily readers, and you wanted to publish something in opposition to it, and you managed to get 10,000 daily readers, you weren't competing. But at least you had some way to get something out.
Well, but now everybody has a way of getting something out through the internet.
That's true.
Social, but nobody has a way of verifying. There's no professionalism in it. There's no standards. There's no ethics. None of that stuff.
No, and there's such an easy way to manipulate it that you get one fascist in Russia and he can set up an institute and all of a sudden you've got hundreds of articles appearing all over the world that make it seem as if they came from Chicago, from Philadelphia, from Boston, but they all came from this right-wing troll factory outside of St. Petersburg. So, you know, that you didn't have years ago.
No, no. And the way things are changing, it's hard to keep up. And it's like whack-a-mole, you know. You might be able to expose one thing and something else occurs.
Yeah, or you do have investigative journalism on the internet. For example, you have The Intercept. But what happens is that if they really do a good job attacking some corporate outfit that's done something horrible, that corporate outfit sues The Intercept. And they've got to now have money to fight the lawsuit. Forget about winning or even possibly losing. Just fighting. Just staying in business while they fight the lawsuit. And it's very hard to have investigative reporting when that kind of manipulation of the legal system is possible.
Yeah, well, didn't Peter Thiel put out that one newspaper with the Hulk Hogan by backing the Hulk Hogan bat lawsuit?
Yes, he put them out of business.
Or was it a newspaper?
It wasn't a newspaper. It was the Gawker, wasn't it?
The Gawker, yeah.
Yeah.
He put them out of business.
Right. That's
and,
right.
Because they outed him as being gay.
Yeah.
As I recall.
Yeah.
And, well, like I said, it's a changing world. Scranton and the northeastern Pennsylvania is, you know, going to be in for a change with that.
I think so. And the politics will suffer. It won't be easier to organize. It'll be harder to organize.
Yeah. You know, you talk about investigative journalism. That ProPublica piece on the Supreme Court, and especially Justices Thomas and Alito. This week, Justice Thomas amended his financial statement. He had asked for a 90-day extension, and all he did was he amended it to bring out the same thing that ProPublica had brought out, but he used the opportunity to try to defend what he had done.
What was his defense?
Well, his defense is, well, I took one private plane ride because when the Dobbs decision leaked, there was a security. I was worried about security, as if he doesn't have security that can be provided to him on a commercial flight. And then another one, he says, I needed a private flight because of an ice storm. I couldn't get a commercial flight. Well, hey, stay over a night at a hotel.
Exactly.
It's a lot cheaper than a flight that's going to cost tens of thousands of dollars.
I mean, don't these fellows get a pretty good salary?
Yeah, it's over $200,000 a year.
You think you could afford an airline's ticket?
Yeah. But he's gotten to the point where he doesn't want to pay for anything. It's just my salary is just the base for me to bank, and anything else I can get away with and not have to pay for, meals or vacations.
Yeah, his kids' education or his ward's education, his mother's house.
Right.
On and on and on and on. This guy, you talk about corporate welfare. Isn't it a form of government welfare? I mean, it's because of his government office that he's able to get all this welfare. So isn't this guy a government welfare cheat?
Well, he's not getting the welfare from the government, but he's using
Well, he's getting government. It through the government, because of the government.
Because of his position. But, of course, they don't see it like that. You know,
no, they don't see
everybody
it.
Else is the welfare cheat, yeah. Not him. He That's deserves right. it. He deserves it.
Yeah, and he does deserve it, really. Because look at the benefit that he provides to the most reactionary trends in American political life. He justifies all of it. He promotes all of it. He aids all of it. He trains the people who administer it. How many of his clerks are now judges or, you know, corporate lawyers someplace, or easing the way for more onslaught against working people, minorities, immigrants?
Yeah.
He's not a nobody.
Look what happens when somebody speaks up against the crowd. We have that North Carolina situation with their state Supreme Court justice.
The only black woman on the court.
Yeah, who had the temerity to point out the fact that people appearing before her and the court, not just her, tended to be overwhelmingly white men. And she asked, where's the diversity? And for that, they decided to investigate her.
And possibly impeach her. They have the right to do that.
With an eye to her impeaching her.
Yeah, yeah.
All these people that talk about freedom, you know, in Wisconsin, they're ready to impeach a justice who just got elected because they don't want her to vote against what they've done in the legislature. They've warned her, either you do what we want to do or we're going to impeach you. Well, that's not exactly separation of powers.
Well, yeah, exactly. Joe Biden got sworn into office. Marjorie Taylor Greene filed articles of impeachment against him the next day. He hadn't a chance to do something wrong.
Well,
even if he wanted to do something wrong, he hadn't had the opportunity to get to it yet.
Yeah. You know, and talking about power, we have that situation in Texas where they're trying to tell people you can't use the public roads if you're going to do something that we don't approve of.
Exactly. Exactly. Because what we have is the Taliban masquerading as MAGA Republicans.
Yeah, well, what that is where they don't want people to help people drive out of state to get an abortion where it's legal.
That's right.
Yeah.
Therefore,
yeah.
You can't be on the road. It's exactly like the Taliban who forbid women from leaving their home without a male escort.
Yeah, interestingly, the female judge in North Carolina, the female justice in Wisconsin, it tends to, you're seeing a pattern.
Or the female DA in Fulton County that the Republicans want to, get rid of because she had the temerity to indict how many people, 19 people, for a RICO-type assault on the American government?
Yeah. Thank goodness the governor said he's not going to go along with that.
Yeah.
And of course, in New York, Trump is going after Letitia James, who just exposed another black woman.
Then there's that horrible black woman judge in Washington, D.C.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Justice Chutkan. It's a tough life. It's a tough life.
It is. It's the end of summer, but it's not the end of conflict for power.
No, it's not. But that won't end. That won't end. And this is Labor Day. We should think about it.
Yes.
See you next week.
See you next week.
You've been listening to Forward with Falk. Longtime Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen discuss politics. Join them again next week, same time, same place.